For me, circularity is the answer to climate change. If we can solve circularity and if we can have a circular economy, we will have solved climate change. We will have worked out how to manage the embodied emissions. We will be relying on renewable energies, and we will have great, robust, economic growth without this, hey, we need to take that, burn that, get rid of that.
That is Joe Taranto, the Chief Executive of Good for the Hood, speaking on an Australia Institute webinar entitled Transitioning to a Circular Economy. The host for the show was Nina Gabor, who is the Director of the Circular Economy and the Waste Program at the Australia Institute. First, we'll hear a little more from the webinar, and you can find a link for the entire event in the show notes.
So, Joe, thank you for being our guest today in our very first circular economy program, as I mentioned, for this year. And it's really fitting that we're kicking off the year with a conversation about circularity. So, on that note, I will start by asking you to tell us how you describe the circular economy, particularly for those in the back of the room who are perhaps new to this concept.
Thanks so much, Nina, and thanks to everyone for joining today. It's always a bit nerve-wracking when you're the first off for the year, and Nina says that there's still lots of people registered, so that's wonderful. Thanks for having me. I'm coming from the land of the Wallumattagal today, the Snapperfish people on the Darug Nation in lower North Shore of Sydney. I live in North Ryde, and the circular economy is... I guess it's a bit of a buzzword for people, Nina, and it kind of means two things. It simultaneously means the way we look at things that flow through our economy. So things being materials and commodities, and often we talk about waste associated with that. The circular economy is also the systems that enable a value-led economy. So when people use the word, sometimes they're talking about the specific flow of something, and sometimes they're actually talking about, you know, the entire system. Much like when someone talks about the economy, they can mean multiple different things. It's a really, I describe it as meaty, and as a vegetarian, I use that quite loosely, but meaty in the fact that it is dense. It's really hard to explain it simply to people, because as soon as you dig down, everyone starts coming at it from a different level. But for me, it's about decoupling economic growth or prosperity from finite resources. Mm. So drawing a line in the sand and saying, well, okay, we can't have infinite economic prosperity in a country where we rely primarily on extraction and a linear model. So circular economy is about keeping value in the economy without having to have this cycle of extraction and waste. And there's lots in it, but it's basically redesigning the economy so that that works.
Yeah, it's interesting how growth is critical to, you know, whether it's an election or the economy itself. And growth literally, if we look behind it, means extracting resources to create, in most cases, extracting resources to create products to increase wealth. And that's loosely, very loosely, what defines growth. And, you know, it's such a linear model. And yeah, I think, you know, we have to redesign and actually look at what that actually means from an environmental perspective, certainly from a circular economy perspective. Thank you so much for clarifying that. So on a different note, over the last few years, you know, you've clearly done a huge amount of work with engaging people, engaging corporations, councils, community groups, you know, into this circularity space. So talk to us about how you got started versus where you are now, and how the circularity conversation has shifted over the years.
Yeah, so my background's actually as a health professional. I did an applied science degree at university and worked within the healthcare sector. So I have a very strong sense of health and well-being as a core tenet of what a good society is. I think that's been part of my work even to this day now. When we talk about, you know, what a good community and a good economy is, for me, it's like we've got healthy people. So I think that's a core tenet of my values. I ended up working in a safety role. So I was working with a health safety, compliance, and environmental regulation within the private sector. And then about 8 years ago, you know, mid having kids and looking at what I wanted to do with the rest of my career, I really felt that my skills with systems change and looking at influencing behavior, which is basically what I was doing, was constantly looking at what could we do at a policy level, what could we do at a culture level, and what could we do at an individual level. And I realized that they're exactly the sorts of things that we need to do when we're looking at issues like climate change. Yep. The reason I found myself in the circularity space is that for me, circularity is the answer to climate change. If we can solve circularity and if we can have a circular economy, we will have solved climate change. We will have worked out how to manage the embodied emissions. We will be relying on renewable energies, and we will have great, robust, you know, economic growth without this, hey, we need to take that, burn that, get rid of that. So I found myself working with a decision like we all face when we're wanting to transition. Do I go back to uni? Do I go and get a job? Or do I just start where I am? And I had this moment where I went, I'm just going to have a little play in this space and see what lands. And so I started doing a whole bunch of work in my community at the citizens level, like a lot of people probably on this call, getting involved in local repair cafes, looking at community gardens, doing cleanups, you know, going to clothes swaps, doing all those really citizens level functions, because one, it felt safe with a young family, and it really let me explore that space. But I started realizing that the reason I love those things and I'm really passionate about it is not just because they're really nice things, but it fundamentally, that's what a circular economy needs to have in it to work at a local level. And so I've given most of the last 6 years looking at how we can encourage, particularly at a local government level, increasing participation from citizens around the circular economy, so that not only do they participate there, but also so they can then get increased agency, so they're involved in other aspects outside just their home and their community. Because when systems change, we need people to operate at multiple levels. So we don't just say, look, sort your own house out and you'll be fine. We get people really activated and say, right, okay, well, what could you do now? And how else could you influence the ecosystem? And I think that's the place we like to play, local with a global.
You can hear the rest of that webinar by clicking on the Australia Institute link in the show notes. Next, we have a short promo from the Smart Energy Council promoting its Smart Energy 2024, a conference and exhibition coming up in Sydney on March 6 and 7. It says, Smart Energy 2024 is back bigger than ever. Get ready to immerse yourself in a symphony of innovation and inspiration at Smart Energy 2024, the unmissable rendezvous for all things renewables. Hear from leading decision makers and expert speakers. Explore the newest trends and products from more than 100 exhibitors. Discover the latest smart solutions and enjoy brilliant networking opportunities, all in one and free to attend. You'll find a link for the conference in the show notes.
Australia is electrifying, and this event has been absolutely electric. Huge buzz around the event this year, but guess what? It's just the start. The government expects over the next 6 years, this industry, smart energy, will grow by 300%. By 2060, they predict 1 million workers in our industry. This is going to take over the Australian economy. Friends, we are in the right place.
The opportunities for our country are just so enormous, as every one of you in this room knows, and as every one of you are exhibiting outside. You know that to achieve our 82% renewable energy target and our 43% emissions reduction target, you understand the size of the task we have. We have now not a second to waste. Let's get on with it. Thank you.
It's super important for us as a company to be on site, be in person with our installers, our vendors, and just really have that close collaboration with them. It's a great opportunity for everyone to just connect.
You have all the greatest minds to come together, and collaboration in communities. That's pretty much what we want to achieve.
So this show has been absolutely fantastic. The biggest floor plan in our history, the most number of delegates engaged and learning. I've personally counted over 10,000 people across the 2 days. It's been huge. And folks, this is just the beginning. We're going from strength to strength.
But it's important to be able to come together in various forums like this, to be able to talk to people about what they're doing, how the regulations are moving forward, how the industry's moving forward, and what we can do together. Because no one's going to do anything in isolation. It's about doing things as a group.
To get to your customers, to get value for money, and to get that showing and that brand awareness, you've got to be here.
We are talking to policymakers, government, industry. The sessions are great. There's, you know, high level of educational content. And for us, it's really great for brand awareness and lead generation.
It's a great way as well of understanding where the market is at and finding business opportunities after all, because, you know, we're all companies, we're all here to build a better future but make money in the process as well.
We come from a long way, all the way from Spain, and Australia is a big market for us, and this conference specifically is one of the best out there in the market, so we couldn't miss it.
My advice to any organisations in this industry is to get on board with the Smart Energy Council. Support helps grow, and that's what this industry is doing right now. It's growing. So the more support the Smart Energy Council can have, the more they can support the growth.
Well, the good news is there's not long to wait, because we're going to be back in March. Get that? March 6th and 7th, 2024, the Festival of Smart Energy, completely free of charge to attend. Such an exciting place to be. You'd be crazy not to be here. Come and join the action at the Smart Energy Conference 2024.
Next, we have some audio from the Australian Broadcasting Corporation's Radio National Breakfast program about the rise in e-scooter injuries concerns doctors.
From Ballarat to Bundaberg, e-scooters are, depending on your perspective, the new menace on Australian roads or a transport revolution. In Melbourne, they whiz down footpaths and weave through busy CBD traffic. In other cities too, sometimes two people to a scooter, often neither wearing helmets. So it's perhaps not surprising that there's been an explosion in head injuries linked to the electric vehicles. In Victoria alone, almost 1,000 people were treated in hospital following accidents last year. The Victorian chair of the Royal Australasian College of Surgeons is paediatric neurosurgeon Dr. Patrick Lowe. And Dr. Lowe joins us this morning. Welcome.
Yeah, good morning, Patricia. Thanks for having me on.
What sort of injuries are we talking about here?
We're seeing across-the-board injuries, not just head injuries. We're seeing spinal injuries, orthopaedic injuries, blunt trauma. It's really a mixed bag of conditions.
And how big is the increase? Have you noticed it yourself?
Yeah, I actually thought it was my own practice, being skewered towards seeing road traumas and pediatric head injuries. But it seems across the board, and this is reflected in data from overseas as well, that there has been a massive boom. I think if you talk to any of the emergency departments across the city, across the country, they will say exactly the same thing.
The minimum legal age to ride an e-scooter is 16. Would you like to see age restrictions?
I think it's difficult. We all know the minimum legal age to drink alcohol is 18, and try to enforce that. So I think there's a deeper problem here. I agree with some of the comments made that this is a revolutionary transport system. And if it's going to be with us, and it certainly seems like it's going to be with us, something else needs to be done about it. Policing is great, but our police forces is already stretched to the limit. So shouldn't something else be done? Perhaps education?
Education. What does education look like, though? I mean, the education piece is obviously key with anything you want to do where there are dangers. But what would switch people's behaviour here?
The thing is, even with driving a car or learning to ride a bike, there's some way of teaching individuals how to do so. It just seemed like the e-scooters popped up one day. Now, a few years back, I remember people throwing them into the canal or up a tree, but slowly came on without any fanfare. And one day I just saw a whole bunch of e-bikes on the side of the road. So there has to be advertising to teach young patients or young individuals, the rest of the community, to learn the safety. It's not like the scooters that we grew up with. Yeah, in the scooters we grew up with, we use our own strength, our own speed of running to propel the scooter. These things are going, even though they might be going at 20 k's an hour, that's 20 k's an hour. That's quite fast. And when we want to get off our old scooter, we just drop the scooter and come off. But if you drop the e-scooter, you're having a lot of injuries here.
So it's injuries like that where people just don't get the seriousness of jumping off one of these things.
That's one way. Another way is with bike riding, for example, you lean into corners. But if you start leaning using a scooter, you fall off. There's no balance there. Just to put my side of this specialty, helmets are important to reduce the severity of injuries. But how many times have you seen people wear helmets riding e-scooters? So something in that educational field, or even asking the companies that make it, put a tether on the helmet so that it's always connected to the bike. And when it's disconnected, that's when you have your charge going through and you have to reconnect it so you don't lose the helmet. That's just, we've got to start novel ways to deal with this. And I've read articles from overseas and they're calling this an epidemic.
Yeah, they are. Is there anywhere where they're doing it right?
Oh, I haven't heard any. I'm just reading some of the reports from overseas, and they're a little bit more advanced than us in the use of e-scooters. And what they're seeing frightens me, because there's nothing that's curbing the numbers that they're seeing in the emergency presentations.
If you could give advice to regular or casual users of these vehicles, what would it be?
I think please treat it as a vehicle, as you say. It's a motorized vehicle. It is not as simple as a scooter, a skateboard, or even a bike. They are motorized and they can really cause harm. The worry I have is not now. We might see in the first, it's in the, three or four years since it's been around. What we're going to be seeing are injuries that have long-term life-changing effects. For example, if you had a head injury with a tiny little small bruise on the surface of the brain, that bruise, when 20 years down the track, can lead to learning difficulties, can learn to epilepsy, can learn to behavioral issue. And with each of these presentations down the track and currently, you're putting strains on the health system. When the emergency department is trying to sort everything else, you throw in an extra X amount of e-scooter injuries, and it really loads up the health system.
How many of the injuries are also people drinking and getting on these things?
That, I think that also comes to the education side, because I've had a patient recently who essentially thought they were doing the right thing. Okay, I've had a bit to drink, so I better not drive the car. I've read about all the car accidents and the road toll. Yeah, I'll be good for society. You know what? I'm just going to hop on an e-scooter. I can't find a helmet. I've got to get home. No, that's okay. E-scooters are safe. Let's just do it whilst I'm well over the alcohol limit.
So in that case, somebody who actually thought they were doing the right thing because they weren't getting behind behind a car, basically. They weren't going to drive a car.
Correct. It's not fair to them to put all the onus on them to, inverted commas, do the right thing. They feel they're doing the right thing. But where we're falling is teaching them to do the right thing. It's no good, you know, using the analogy of the carrot and stick. It's no use beating them or enticing them. You actually have to teach them. You got to teach the donkey to walk first before you can hit it with a stick or entice it with a carrot.
It's a very important conversation, I think, given it's so much more widespread than it used to be. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me on, Patricia.
Dr. Patrick Lowe is the Victorian Chair of the Royal Australasian College of Surgeons. This is ABC RN Breakfast.
Join me now as we shift to a story from the Washington Post, and the story is by Adam Taylor, and it tells us, or it has the headline, Global military spending hits record $2.2 trillion amid multiple wars. Worldwide military spending surged by 9% on year in 2023 to hit a record $2.2 trillion as multiple conflicts ratcheted up global insecurity, according to a new report by the International Institute for Strategic Studies released on Tuesday. Not only are we spending obscene amounts of money on killing each other, those same wars are sending our global carbon dioxide emissions through the roof, and they are killing thousands of people. The US military alone is the world's largest user of fossil fuels. We don't have any real records because they don't produce them, but the US military has carbon-burning machines all around the world. The deaths caused by the military, and of course, the carbon dioxide emissions, are horrifying. Yes, we've reached the end of this episode of Climate Conversations. Thanks so much for your coming. It's been great to feel along. I remember 5 or 6 years ago, I attempted to set up a blog talking about the climate crisis. And in those years, that's 5 or 6 years ago, it was rather difficult to find stories about the climate crisis. I found some, but they were something of a rarity. Today, the stories appear to be everywhere. And maybe that's true, they are everywhere, but they're not sufficient. They should be leading out national newspapers, they should be leading out television news services, and they should dominate radio programs. The stories about the climate crisis should be leading those services, those newspapers. They're not. Life still roars on as if nothing is happening. Well, something is happening. The climate crisis is upon us. Anyway, enough of that. Thanks so much for your company. Now, I'd love you to share this podcast, put it on your networks, let your friends know what's going on with the climate crisis. Encourage them to read this, encourage them to listen to this, and think about the climate crisis. Also, I'm keen to know what you think about this podcast. Good or bad, don't hold back, let me know. You can contact me at art.mclean7@icloud.com. So until we talk again, please take care, stay safe, and please be kind. For everyone you meet is fighting a great battle. Now you take care and stay safe.